I will now pass the baton over to Alicia.
Thank you, Frank. I'm presenting on drafting in the shadow of the law. And you may have heard of the idea of bargaining in the shadow of the law. Because bargaining in legal domains mimics the probable outcome of litigation, the outcomes of litigation provide beacons or norms for the commencement of any negotiations. This concept applies equally well to drafting the agreements that result from our bargains. We have in the back of our minds the case law that interprets particular provisions in particular jurisdictions and the statutes that govern important contract terms, ranging from statutes of limitation and limitations of liability to definitions of trade secrets and whether a waiver of jury trial is valid. We may be contracting around particular aspects of the law or contracting in a way we know is likely to be valid and enforceable. In this part, I'll be starting with negotiation archetypes you should be prepared to encounter in your clients, colleagues, and opposing counsel. Next, I'll cover key pre-negotiation agreements, such as NDAs, MOUs, LOIs, and BAAs, and I will tell you what all those acronyms stand for. I'll follow that with the art of settlement and release agreements, and then close out with nuances under Massachusetts common law. So starting with negotiation archetypes, you may also see these called negotiating styles, conflict management styles, or conflict modes, but they're all talking about the same thing. And they matter in negotiating contracts because you'll find yourself negotiating provisions in your contract with the opposing party or parties and being able to identify the approach that they're taking and your own preferred style will help you resolve impasses and deliver value for your clients. You may not be familiar with negotiation archetypes, but once I explain the concept, I bet you'll find that it resonates for you. There are five main negotiation archetypes, which you see on the screen, but I've also seen them organized into four or even three archetypes. And I'll quickly summarize all five, and then we'll dig into each one a little bit deeper. So the first is avoid, which is refusing to engage. It may be perceived as passive aggressive. Avoiders may deny there's a problem, change the subject, or physically, emotionally, or psychologically withdraw. They may take a quiet revenge rather than engage with you. Competing or being aggressive, they try to win. They're perceived as tough, aggressive negotiators. They're likely to be inflexible, criticize the other party, make threats, deny their own responsibility, and dismiss the other party's arguments. They may argue forcefully using reasoning, precedent, and supporting example, which may sound familiar to many of you. They may withhold information about their true needs and concerns. The next is compromise. And in this, they tend to negotiate where the compromiser gets a little and the other party gets a little. They're more concerned with dividing existing resources and arriving at an acceptable, even if not optimal, outcome. They may appeal to fairness. They may make trade-offs tit for tat. They may seek quick solutions, even in the face of incomplete data or limited information or limited time to negotiate. And it often ends up translating to splitting the baby or haggling quickly and splitting the difference without trying to create value and expand the pie. It also means that often one or both parties settle for less than what they want or need. A compromise may seem fair, but that's both dependent on the initial offers put on the table and encourages taking extreme positions to get a bigger piece of the fixed size pie. The next one is accommodate or concede. They engage, but then they give in. And it's unlike avoiding because the accommodator cares about the other party's needs and about the relationship. So they may give in at the first sign of acrimony. They may deny their needs and concerns and express a desire for harmony. They're generally well-liked by colleagues and opposing parties because they divide the pie to favor the other party and are often generous with information as well. And then the last is collaborating or cooperating. And they seek a win-win where both sides have their needs and goals met, and they create as much mutual value as time permits. So they tend to ask questions, disclose information and interests, be flexible, make supportive remarks, and accept responsibility. Collaborative negotiators also tend to be good listeners, and they are different than compromisers because they are adamant about getting their own needs met, but they do acknowledge that the other party has needs that must be met as well. Now we're going to look at how to turn a negotiation style into a strategy. So when should you strategically avoid? In the book, Guerrilla Negotiating, they say to avoid when you don't care or don't have time, when you're not prepared to negotiate either in general or about a specific issue, when waiting would improve your negotiating position, when you're delaying a bad outcome, when emotions are running high and people need a timeout, or when the demands are unethical or the other party acts in bad faith. The dangers of an avoid strategy is that you leave the other party to fill in the blanks and make assumptions because you're not communicating. Resentment may build towards stalling tactics, and it also gives time for the parties to entrench further into their positions. When should you strategically compete? When there's a fixed resource or a single issue at the center of the conflict and an integrative solution isn't possible. When actions or results are needed quickly. When you're certain something is non-negotiable and immediate compliance is required. It can also be okay when the outcome is more important than the relationship. And it can be an effective defense against another competitive negotiator, though you do need to be careful not to get deadlocked if both sides remain positional. The dangers of using a compete strategy are that overuse of the tactic lets the other side know what behavior to expect and how to better prepare against it. If both sides are roughly equal in power, it can also end up in a deadlock. And last, unchecked competition can burn bridges and leave relationships in tatters. If a negotiator tries to victimize the other side, it can lead to revenge strategies like living up to the letter of the agreement but not its spirit, and thereby trying to reclaim some of the value that was lost in the negotiation. The next is accommodate. And you should consider strategically accommodating when an issue is unimportant to you but important to the other person. When you or your company are at fault and repairing the relationship is critical and you've got nothing else that would benefit the other party. Or if you're in a very weak position. The dangers of an accommodation strategy is that if the other party is a high compete style, they'll see your generosity as a sign of weakness to be taken advantage of. If you use it early in a negotiation, it can leave you with a poor hand to play later on because you'll have little left to offer. It can signal that you have deep pockets and there's more concessions to come. It may appear to an accommodator that they're promoting harmonious relationships, but accommodators often miss creative options that build strong and lasting relationships. And last, they should be careful to consider the other side's view of a particular thing. Just because something is unimportant to you doesn't mean it's also of little value to the other party. So it's important to do your homework to understand the value of a concession to the other party before you make that concession. When should you strategically compromise? When you're pressed for time and you just need a practical solution to get it done, or if you're not dealing with someone you trust or are seeking a long-term relationship, you just need a practical solution in the moment. When the principle of the thing doesn't matter to you, when you're trying to divide a fixed resource, or when you have nothing left to offer and this is the only way to seal the deal and get across the finish line and trying to close a final gap. The dangers of a compromise strategy, you should not use it to compensate for not preparing properly and then just wing it. If the outcome of the negotiation is critical, don't compromise on things you must have. Don't make concessions too quickly. They may not be necessary, and they can lead to an impasse. Both parties win and lose in a compromise, but you need to try to make sure you win the right things and lose the right things. Don't get hung up on negotiating each issue separately. Trade across issues where possible. Starting points can impact the outcome, so parties may take extreme positions at the outset to capture more of the pie. And rushing through the negotiation process can leave both parties feeling unsatisfied with the outcome because they didn't take the time to expand the pie and explore creative solutions more thoroughly. And then last, when to strategically collaborate. When there are multiple issues and both parties are committed to finding an integrative solution, when both parties need to continue the relationship after the mediation or negotiation, such as a divorce, the parents of a special needs student and a school administration, or a customer, vendor, or other business-to-business relationship or partnership. It's also helpful when it's important to understand the other side's feelings and motivations. The dangers of a collaborate strategy are you can sometimes spend too much time on trivial or even on important issues, stalling the negotiation under the weight of information seeking. It can be hard to negotiate collaboratively with someone who just wants to win for their side and doesn't care about your side. You know, in other words, a competitor. Don't give in to competitive negotiators expecting to create goodwill or get a reciprocal concession, because you'll just get asked to give even more. And competitors may take advantage of the information that you share without reciprocating. It's also not appropriate when there's a single issue and no real way to expand the pie, like a limited resource both parties want. So what should you do with all this information? First, you should try to figure out what's your preferred negotiating style. There are some online quizzes that can help you identify this. Then you should try to figure out what your counterpart's style is. You can get clues from your interactions with them, even via phone or email. Do they offer information? Do they raise their objections as concerns rather than taking positions? Do they propose meet-in-the-middle solutions or something creative? Most negotiators have one or two preferred negotiation styles. You may need to adjust your style to adapt to your counterpart or even for a particular issue within a negotiation. Skilled negotiators are flexible in switching their negotiating styles depending on the differing stages of the negotiation, the style that's employed by opposing parties, your role on the negotiating team and the styles of your other team members, like good cop and bad cop, issues on which you enjoy an advantage or face a disadvantage, and key strategic or tactical goals. I can tell you that I've had contract negotiations with collaborators who were pleasant to work with, transparent about their concerns, and open to hearing about my concerns and finding a way to try to meet both our needs. I've also had contract negotiations with positional negotiators who initially refused to budge, citing arguments such as policies they have to adhere to or expectations of their vendors. And the latter negotiations, needless to say, were less pleasant and more difficult and took longer. But by making sure that I understood my counterpart's underlying concerns, I was able to propose creative drafting solutions that met their needs without unduly increasing